is The End User, episode 199 for Thursday, August 13th. Choosy moms, choose GIF. Hello and welcome to The End User, the show where we get together and talk about our experience with consumer technology with a bit of news from your perspective. The End User.
It's the tech news that you can use.
I am your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Futurist Prime, Taylor Ma.
So Taylor, we dropped a couple weeks there, as we have been doing recently. Life gets crazy sometimes. But also, last week, we were 100% raring to go, and I had upgraded to Windows 10, and the preamp for my microphone didn't work. And I hadn't noticed that. So last week was entirely my fault. So sorry about that. But we are here this week. We've got a bunch of news to go over, some big things that have happened in the last couple weeks. And welcome, I guess.
Thanks.
Are you ready to get into show 199? We're edging up to 200 ever so slowly.
I'm ready, but I want to go back to your preamp problem. Did Microsoft say that all your hardware was going to be compatible?
Oh, so this is something I knew was going to happen. In fact, it was probably kind of dumb of me to latch onto the update so quickly. The compatibility of... So I have an MBox 2, and that's the hardware that didn't quite work. So right now what I'm doing is using the general driver that Avid provides, and so I can at least get it into Audacity, but I still haven't gotten my version of Pro Tools to work, and granted it is probably 10 years old at this point. It's 8.03 and it's definitely not ready for Windows 10, and they've definitely been really slow and incompatible in the past, so it's not entirely surprising. So that's probably equal parts my fault and Avid's fault and Windows 10's fault, but mostly Avid's fault.
Ah, there we go. I was waiting for the the main party to come forward.
Yeah, mostly Avid. So so like I said, they make a general driver that other programs can use. So that's what I'm doing now. But I still haven't gotten Pro Tools to work in Windows 10. So maybe I have to upgrade to the latest version of Pro Tools, which is $8.99.
That's the version?
No, that's the price.
It's $9?
No, it's $899 to buy it.
What?
Yeah, it's crazy.
How much does version 898 cost?
Now, so version 803 was one that you bought the hardware for about $300, and they included the version of Pro Tools LE.
And that's what you have?
That's what I had until now. It doesn't work, so now I don't have it.
But you do have Windows 10.
I do have Windows 10, and I do have the standalone driver, and that seems to be working A-OK.
Well, I don't need your review of the driver. We know it's working, but tell me more about Windows 10. I haven't even seen it.
Taylor, I'm really impressed with this this ASIO driver from Avid. It's working really well right now. So I did want to at least, you know, I don't know, take 10 or 15 minutes just to talk about the ASIO driver.
Everyone who can hear you right now is grateful that it's working, and no one wants to hear that.
Yeah, absolutely. I am glad that I got it to work, because that was there was some uncertainty in that it would work. So
you really want to talk about this driver for 15 minutes,
that's
don't you?
Nice. No. Let's talk about Windows 10. We're going to lead off with that. So since the last time we podcast, Windows 10 has gone through general availability as an update to just about any version of Windows that you probably have. And it just kind of shows up and downloads itself. They staggered out the downloads, and I went ahead, and there was some command line thing that you could run that would force the update. So I went ahead and did that, and it actually didn't work at first, but then after a couple tries, it stuck, and Windows 10 floated down to me. Now, after that, I've been wanting to do this for some time. I wanted to kind of back up all my data and just reinstall everything, and I felt like with the problems I was having with the drivers, it was a good opportunity to do that. So I went ahead, and after the upgrade, to get the experience of a clean install, I went ahead and downloaded the ISO and did the update, or did a clean install that way, and then, you know, reinstalled all my apps. So both of those processes were pretty simple, you know. It didn't require any babysitting or anything. It just kind of downloaded it once I told it to, and the update happened pretty seamlessly. And it only took about 10 minutes on this machine.
Wow, that's pretty impressive. The whole thing?
Yeah, not including the download. I mean, only the install process was about 10 minutes.
Wow, that's crazy even from a Mac perspective.
Yeah, yeah, because Macs are usually what, like, I don't know, 15 maybe?
They've been speeding it up. It's gone from like, it was like an hour with the DVD, and then they got it down to like 45 minutes with Lion, and then half hour with Mountain Lion, and now it's down to like 20 minutes.
Yeah, yeah, that's about right. So throughout both the process of updating it in place and then clean installing it, I was fairly impressed with how seamless that was.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. So what else? I mean, actually using, what's it like?
Particularly on a desktop, which is what I'm using it on, the usability improvements are vast. And, you know, it just, we kind of knew this, and we've talked a little bit about this before, but the way all the apps work now is really in a desktop native format. And I also, if you go over to listen to Entertainment 2.0 with Josh Pollard over there, he talks about some of the usability features of the tablet operating system having been a little bit less than stellar for the tablet version. But if you are using it on a desktop or a laptop, then the usability of it is staggeringly better. And, you know, I didn't mind Windows 8.1. I felt like there was some, or Windows 8 and 8.1, there's something that needs to change in desktop operating systems in general. And I believe that's true across the board of OS X and Windows both. I think they're still just too complicated with comparing it to other experiences like iPad and Android tablets and that kind of thing. And just even leaving touch out of the equation, I feel like there's a lot of complications that don't need to exist. But what they have done is make that desktop user experience a whole lot better. So now all of your apps formerly known as Metro will run in windowed mode. All your desktop apps work like they normally do, and they've kind of overhauled the way the start menu works, and it feels a lot slicker.
I agree that that's in the long term, you know, in the future, something needs to change. Where everybody basically has a nicer version of the operating system they were running 15 years ago at this point.
Yep.
And, you know, at some point, you've got to look at the advances technology has made and say, we need a new paradigm.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I think if you're looking at it like I am and thinking about the user experience that one gets from some of the newer devices that have kind of had the opportunity to rethink what they're doing, stuff is a lot better, you know. So there's one example I always like to bring up, and that's, you have a desktop, and you have an icon on the desktop, and you click on the icon, what happens?
Nothing.
Well, no, so something happens. Well, hopefully.
Well, you double-click on it, and then it
Well,
happens.
Okay, yeah. So you double-click on it. Okay, point number one, taken. For some reason, you double-click on it, so you double-click on it, and what happens?
It opens.
Right. So it opens with what?
I don't the question.
So you have an icon that is able to be opened by many applications, and you double click on it, and it may open. It may not have a application associated with that file type, and it may do all of these crazy things. When I feel like that's completely unnecessary. There is no situation in the iPad and in an Android tablet where that is the kind of experience you would expect, and yet. That's what we have on all desktop operating systems.
Oh, but I mean, once you're within an application on the iPad, there are all sorts of instances where you click on something and it says, well, what do you want to do with this?
Yeah, fair. Like the share dialogue would be a pretty good example.
Yeah. I mean, if you click on a certain thing, the share dialogue opens up automatically. But then Apple decided, well, we want the share dialogue to be consistent. And so they said, well, so everybody use the same share dialogue. This is what's going to open up when the iPad doesn't know what to do.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I don't want to go off on a crazy tangent, but I feel like there is still a lot of room for growth on both Windows and OS X and Linux. There's still a lot of room for growth in all of those products and making them simpler for you know, I feel like there's going to be this generation of people who have grown up and perhaps not used full-fledged desktop operating system until they're maybe a little older, and they're going to get confused.
Oh, yeah. That generation is the kids who are using iPads and iPhones and iPod touches and Android phones, either on or off contract. Like, they're already doing it now. And when they get to those desktop interfaces, they're going to be more confused than they expected.
Yeah, that's a good point. So, I don't know. But anyway, we've gone down that rat hole far enough, but there's definitely room for improvement there. But Windows 10, Taylor, is definitely a huge improvement. And I was anticipating a rockier rollout than they've had. I've seen some people complaining about some bugs. There was one bug I saw on Twitter that flew by where they had a Windows 10 error dialogue that said, "Something has happened."
Yeah, and then the sub-dialogue was, "Something happened." I really, really enjoyed that one because of Schadenfreude.
Right. But from what I've seen, you know, anytime you have a software rollout as large as something like Windows, you know, stuff's going to happen. But from what I've heard from people who have updated it, you know, friends and at work and that kind of thing, it's been pretty smooth going. And that's kind of encouraging. But again, clearly some engineer at Microsoft left some kind of like, you know, debug thing in there that was just like, wow, something happened. And then they looked at it and they say, okay, well, now I know something happened.
Although do you have any idea what caused that? Has anyone replicated it?
So, no. I mean, it's not like I've gone and researched it, but I haven't seen any follow-up. But I'm absolutely sure it was just kind of a little mistake that an engineer made in doing something.
Something happened.
Something definitely happened.
Something.
Anyway, so I still am a little dubious about the usefulness of Cortana on the desktop. You know, I kind of played around with it a little bit. It's sitting there right next to your start button in the lower left corner of Windows 10. And, you know, I kind of took it for a tour and you know, asked it some things, and that was pretty much it. I'll probably not use that very often.
I want to go back through the archives and find out all that you've been dubious.
Probably a fair bit of things I've been dubious of.
That's what I'm thinking, yeah.
Are you dubious of me being dubious of software?
No, that would be ridiculous.
So anyway, what else can we say? You really have to experience it to, you know the differences between 8.1 and Windows 10, you know, it's staggeringly different for the desktop experience, definitely in a positive way. So I'm still kind of exploring things and how a lot of this stuff is working. Because, you know, at the end of the day, it's mostly the same. If you're coming from Windows 7, you're going to be comfortable. But they've expanded the start menu to include the tiles for various applications, including all of the formerly full screen application, and they now open in windowed. It's just kind of a different experience, and for the people who skipped 8.1 and 8, they'll probably be very comfortable moving to Now, Taylor, here's a question that keeps me up at night, is do we think that given that Microsoft has moved in this direction, are a lot of these modern apps that were really the first class citizens in the Windows 8 and 8.1, you know, they're treated differently, and the live tiles are in the are kind of ferreted away in the start menu. And I feel like developers who jumped all in on these apps may feel a little burned by that.
First of all, this is what keeps you up at night?
Well, yeah, no, just a figure, I suppose.
And I mean, I think that there are a lot of, frankly, there are a lot of which we've talked about broadly over the last year or so, not so much specifically because we haven't done so many shows this summer, but Microsoft has cut a lot of loose threads.
Yeah, it's true.
In the last year. And, you know, this seems like a minor fork in what's still a fundamentally supported operating. There's, you know, think about the developers who are working on Windows RT or, you know, a lot of the stuff that Windows Phone is not going to be around anymore. So sure, I'm absolutely certain that there are some developers who are miffed, but I think that for the majority of them, at least, you know, this is not their main grievance.
Yeah, that's probably true. I feel like most of them were probably maybe upset at the experience of the Windows 8.x round of things anyway.
Right. I think Microsoft had all of this in mind. You know, meetings were had about it. They talked about it. This was the way they decided to move forward. So, you know, it's not that big a loss for them, and they know exactly how much of a loss it is. So that's how I feel.
Yeah.
But it doesn't affect me all that much.
Well, that's true. That's true. So, so anyway, I think the attitude that I've gotten from folks around the web have been largely positive, and I think that if this is the version of Windows that they are going to start incrementally updating over time and not having these big bang releases that can cause more problems, then I think they've got a pretty solid foundation on which to build. And I look forward to see, you know, what they kind of add to this product over time, as long as they keep their promise of these kind of continuous updates. You know, they're kind of taking the approach that Chrome has taken with small continuous updates instead of these big bang releases. So if that's their path forward, then I'm encouraged with this as a foundation.
Except you're eventually going to have to pay for them.
Well, yeah, we'll see how that shakes out. So you do, when you upgrade, they do give you a license. And now here's a fun little fact. So they're doing something interesting. When I so I updated to Windows 10 and then I erased it and, you know, backed up all my data, erased it and did a clean install, like we mentioned, and I automatically got a license because of something they have done, like profiling hardware or something like that. So when I did the clean install the second time around there, the license just kind of said, oh, you know, hi there, that's fine. You have a license now.
Well, that's pretty nice.
Yeah, so not once did I enter in that ridiculous long string of yesteryear that you had to verification string or whatever you call it.
Yeah, I haven't even thought about
it. Yeah. So anyway, I don't want to, we're up coming up on 20 minutes here, and I don't want to drone on about Windows 10, because we have talked about a lot of the features that it has before, but I did want to mention, you know, what my experience was and what, you know, what's going on with that. So last thing perhaps about Windows 10, and that is the new browser seems pretty nice from what I've gathered from it, but it's definitely got a lot of missing parts, Taylor. So one, for example, is you can't view the this is Microsoft's new Edge browser, which we've talked about in the past. It's apparently
formerly Spartan,
and it's last time I read, at least, it was the most HTML5 compliant browser out there. They've implemented the most of the spec of all the browsers, so that's kind of cool. But it definitely has some holes. It's downright simple for now, and I feel like they've got this foot in the door. And they're going to add all, you know, some of the features over time to this thing. But I can't even view the certificate of the site I'm visiting. So there's a little lock indicating that that it is encrypted. But I definitely cannot view the actual certificate information. And there's a little lock for domain validation certs, like I have. And there's the EV certs with the big green trust bar, you know, with the company. But I can't view the actual certificate in as far as I've been able to find yet.
Right, you just get its logo.
Yeah, it's just like, okay, well, there was a certificate and we verified it. Not what is it, when did it expire, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that's, again, probably something they considered and decided not to include it. They're not going after, like, they're not trying to get widespread developers, just trying to get people to use it.
Yeah, and I think that's something they'll add. And if you want that kind of thing, you can go use IE 11 for now.
Oh, come on, Chris. You'll just go use Chrome.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you really wanted to stay in the Microsoft ecosystem for whatever reason, you're totally right. I pretty much don't use it, but definitely use Chrome most often than not. But If you for whatever reason wanted to stay in that ecosystem, you would go use IE 11, and you would get a lot of those features that you're missing.
Yeah, or I don't know, Firefox. What devs?
Yeah,
like.
Or Firefox. That's fine too. Or Opera, perhaps.
All right, but I mean, do you like it? Do you think it's capable as a browser? You know,
yes.
How does it compare to, say, Safari?
Yeah, I absolutely think that they've done a good job. I haven't noticed, and again, I haven't really used it that much, other than to kind of kick the tires. But it seems like a certainly capable browser. IE 11, by the way, was certainly is currently and previously certainly capable browser. Would I be worried if my parents were using it like you might have been for older IE versions? And the answer to that would be no. I wouldn't necessarily recommend that switch away from it just for the sake of switching away from it. But you know, particularly for power users who want plugins and want all kinds of different features like that, then you definitely would probably want to go with Chrome, Firefox, or IE 11, because it's just not really complete yet.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like it from an ecosystem perspective, but as a product, I think it's...
Yeah, I think the kind of core experience of the thing is complete, and they do have some neat features. You know, I haven't used this yet, but the share and markup, the page you're viewing seems kind of neat, and you know, from a web development perspective, it being an HTML5 compliant browser, I think that's a pretty big win. If people can start using it, then it will render the web competently, so that's
that
pretty
part
nice.
I'm actually pretty confused about, like, how is it more compliant than other browsers?
Yeah, there's stuff in the spec that haven't been implemented yet.
Don't understand.
And in various browsers, the spec is in various points of getting implemented. So anyway, I don't want to get off into the weeds with that. But it's definitely a competent browser. I feel like they're going to add something. That's what we'll kind of be looking forward
to. All right, good.
So we'll get there. We'll get there.
Yeah, that's how Microsoft is feeling these days. They'll get there.
Yeah, we'll get there. Slowly but surely.
Virtual reality, we'll get there.
Yeah, we'll get there. That should be their tagline, I guess, right?
Then that they would not get there. That would not go well.
Yeah, no.
Not that, well at all.
That might end poorly for them. So, Taylor, one last Microsoft story in the top news here, and I am very excited. This is back from August 4th in GeekWire, and it was all over the web. And Microsoft has unveiled some functionality related to the Xbox One DVR features, which have kind of perked my ears up a little bit. It's happening, Taylor.
Yes, I'm a little bit excited about this, only because I feel like they're cannot be that many people who are interested in over-the-air Wi-Fi on their Xbox.
Well, no, I'm talking about over-the-air TV on the
Xbox. Oh, yeah, over-the-air TV with DVR. But still, not a big market segment.
No, that's definitely true, and I just happen to be somebody who wants that. And, you know, a lot of people, I'm sure a lot of people who are listening to Entertainment 2.0 over there at the DMZ are really excited about this kind of development. But I think you're right, as a mass market...
Really? They don't already have... I feel like everybody who's listening to Entertainment 2.0 has a great smart DVR solution that they're already comfortable with. Like, why do they need it on their Xbox?
Yeah, well, I think with support dwindling for Windows Media Center, this is going to be the future in the same ecosystem. Now, there's plenty of support left for Windows Media Center, no doubt. There's many years left of support for Media Center. But kind of looking into a crystal ball into the future, whatever Microsoft does with this is the solution going forward after Media Center meets its demise in a handful of years.
That seems like a dire future.
Yeah, and well, again, it's very far into the future. It'll be, I'd have to look up exactly what the number is, but there are many, many years of support for that to happen. But to see them open up some DVR capabilities for over-the-air TV with the potential for some further, maybe... I don't know, cable card, or I don't know, but some cable options into the future is a very exciting opportunity. And, you know, if you go with an Xbox, it's, you know, you don't have to maintain this extra computer that's sitting underneath your TV. It's just the Xbox. It's kind of an appliance. And I feel like that's, that kind of stability can be a nice thought. Now, all that said, you know, I'm kind of speculating wildly because they haven't done most of what I just... They're simply doing over-the-air TV watching on the Xbox, and they've announced that they are going to get DVR capabilities in 2016. So it's not like we have it yet. And it's also, we don't have hardware that is beyond one tuner. If the... the Hauppauge WinTV 955Q is the currently supported tuner, so that is a single tuner. So, you know, I'm looking at this as a harbinger for some of the future of television consumption in the Microsoft platform, and this seems to be like something that they're going to do. And currently, I use Windows Media Center for over-the-air TV only anyway, so it particularly strikes my little knee.
Wow, their motto really could be, we'll get there.
Yeah, so, you know, like I said, it's something they've announced. It's not something we have. We have live TV now on Xbox One, but if they go whole hog on this solution, I will definitely be buying an Xbox One. I'll tell you that.
Wow. Okay. Major endorsement.
Yeah. So we'll kind of see what they. We're a little bit in rumor town there, so we'll kind of see what they're doing going forward with that. But Taylor, I wanted to get out of Microsoft news at the top of the show here and get into some Google news.
Yeah, that's what the people want to hear about. Not even Google news. Google is old hat. It's not even a thing anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a thing, but it's also not a thing because now Alphabet is the big kid on the block.
Yeah, I guess we kind of buried the lead, but we went organically into the Windows conversation. But
and if you've had your head in a cave for the last week, you could say, what? How is a company that I've never heard of bigger than... Well, that's because Google turned into Alphabet, and now Alphabet is just one little piece, or Google is one little piece of Alphabet. They've got all this other stuff going on, and frankly, I'm pretty worried about it.
Oh, really? What do you think? Do you think that them splitting all of their assets off into different companies is worrisome from like a product integration standpoint or something like that?
No, it's much more fundamental than that. See, Google had this motto, and it was the thing that made us be like, okay, Google, you can have all our, you know, you can learn everything about us. You can creepily prescient about every aspect of our lives because your company motto is do no evil.
Yeah, so I haven't heard. Oh, so we should say up front here, Alphabet is a new company that Google has kind of created that is an umbrella company that owns many other companies, among which are Google. And Google has various properties like Android Search, YouTube, their App Store, and Maps and advertisements. They've got Nest, which is the home automation thermostat. They've got Google Capital, Google X, Fiber, and Calico is a smaller one. So they're kind of splitting off a lot of companies that have these kind of individual purposes, I think.
And freeing them to do...
Right. So what I haven't heard is if the companies not named Google under the Alphabet umbrella are also keeping that tagline.
Yeah, if they did, I think you would have heard about it.
Yeah, so and by the way, the stock of Google went through the roof on this news. I guess it's something that Wall Street likes, but what do they know?
Not a whole lot about tech.
So I could come at this from either side. I could see it being good for, you know, kind of splitting off their projects into their own little, silos in that each one of these may be able to do a more competent job without the, you know, management structure of Google or whatever, and doing their own little thing and acting in their own little interest. I could kind of see an argument for that being a good thing. I don't think there's necessarily any reason for Nest and Google to necessarily be aligned if their kind of mission statement of this home automation thermostat and YouTube are completely different from one another. So I could kind of see it from that angle as well. But the other side of me, the more cynical side of me, looks at it and says, well, okay, now they're going to fight over things like they used to at Microsoft.
Yeah, I really don't know. I mean, it actually does totally make sense from a business perspective. And, you know, they can run things more efficiently, probably. But, you know, a name's just a name. The open letter that Larry Page wrote was talking about, you know, they wanted to be lean and uncomfortable and fast moving, but, you know, you just turned yourself into a giant umbrella corporation. You think that's going to make you more nimble as a company?
Yeah, well, and I think, yes, I think in some respects they will be able to have each one of these little these definitely not little companies, you know, move in their own interests. But I do wonder kind of where their loyalty lies to, you know, the umbrella company and how strong that tie is. It kind of depends on how Alphabet actually manages this conglomerate of companies.
Yeah, exactly. So if they're managing it like really hands off, that's one thing. But at some point, there's going to be that confluence of interest. They're going to fight over something.
Yeah, so I could definitely foresee that. So it entirely depends on how this goes. Now, Taylor, I couldn't help but think of Netflix trying to split off into Quixtar. I know it's a completely unrelated thing, and I know it really has nothing to do with anything with Google here, but for some reason, I couldn't help but think of the Quixtar debacle over at Netflix, saying it's the same kind of language you see in the press release on their blog. You know, they're going to split into two companies so they can be more nimble. They're going to focus on their two niches in the case of Quixtar and Netflix. And this is basically the same thing on a, you know, more massive, gigantic scale.
Yeah, I can see that. I was thinking about that this as well. Well, that didn't go well for Netflix.
No, it sure didn't.
You know, it had a much more visceral reaction. Like, Netflix reversed that decision not because it was a good or bad business decision, but because all of their customers basically said, wait, what? No. Seriously, no. No, I mean, well, no. Definitely no. I thought about it, and
yeah, and
what all their customers said.
In this case, I do think that when you say the word Google, you know, we probably won't talk about Alphabet very much, right? I think when we're talking about Google in the tech industry, it's still going to be all the same properties that people associate Google with in the first place. So I don't think that it's a bad move like Quixtar perhaps might have been.
Even Nest Labs, you know, even all their weird stuff that isn't technically no longer under the Google name, people are still going to call it Google. They're going to say Google's doing this, Google's doing that. And they're not going to call it Alphabet.
Yeah, the Google Nest.
Although I did like, my favorite part of the announcement was their launch of Google XYZ.
Yes. Google.xyz.
It's a direct reference to Silicon Valley, the funniest shows on television right now, especially regarding tech from Hulu. XYZ was the division that they gave Big Head to run. And so now they have a profile of Big Head on a Google website running this fictional division.
Nice. By the way, I've started watching that show recently, and it's fantastic. Highly recommended.
Yeah.
Silicon Valley.
I'm sure I've mentioned it on the show before. Yeah. Worth reiterating. Very good show.
So anyway, I think it's more interesting from an economic and business perspective than it really is from the end user. I think the end user is really going to look at this and say, well, yeah, Google and Gmail and Android and search and YouTube are all the same now. They're still the same, and they will continue to be the same. So, you know, I'm not sure how much – it's huge news, obviously, but I'm not sure how much it will really affect the end user, aside from maybe the Nest part of it.
Okay. Immediate Nest brand loyalty question, right? So Nest was originally an independent company. They were purchased by Google, and they were immediately or not immediately, but eventually their connectivity with Google products became – a little geared more towards Google. So it's a smart thermostat, right? And it has Wi-Fi and it connects to the internet. And there's an Android app, there's an iOS app, there's a web app, there's a Windows Phone app. I don't know if there's a BlackBerry app. Maybe it's possible. But once they were acquired by Google, app got a lot more support for Android. And when Apple announced HomeKit compatibility, Nest was nowhere to be found. And in fact, Apple no longer sells Nest in their stores because there is a competing HomeKit compatible thermostat.
Yeah, so I do wonder if that could change a little bit, given that they're kind of spinning out.
Right. Nest is no longer part of Google, it's part of Alphabet. And it's in their market share interest to make themselves more cross-platform compatible. So are they going to do that? Does Google have any problem with that? These are the kinds of questions that are going to come up a lot. And that's an easy one. That's just off the top of my head.
Yeah, exactly. That is the question, isn't it? So we'll see how that kind of interplay happened over time here.
All right. So we won't get any answers.
Nope, we sure won't.
Google would just say, oh, everything's fine. It's good.
Yeah, we're all good. Don't worry about us. We're good over here.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, other things that are good in this world, Taylor, are getting into the afterburners. So if you, in fact, have your seatbelt securely fastened, we can get started with.
Yeah, I had to fasten my seatbelt during that rocky transition.
Ouch. So Intel is promising that their next generation Skylake CPUs are actually going to be some kind of unlocked version. So that's definitely encouraging to see from them. And it's definitely encouraging to see Skylake come out because I believe they were released very shortly ago here as well.
Yeah, they released their two highest end desktop chips. And,
yes, so
and it's in fact, they're unlocked and overclockable. And they've also released a new class of Xeon processor, the server class, hardcore, super fast process. But the interesting thing about these first two Skylake chips is that they released the previous version, the Broadwell version, in like May, June. So they have replaced an entire segment of their processor line in like less than, which is pretty funny. But they're expected to announce a couple of more chips over the next couple of weeks.
Right. So that was from August 5th. So about a week ago, they had that kind of official release for Skylake. That's cool to see. It kind of came out of nowhere.
The fact that they would be unlocked?
Yeah, just the fact that the chip was in the pipeline and was released as soon as it
was. Oh, we've talked about it on the show a little before.
Yeah, we've talked about it a little bit. I feel like it crept up on me.
The whole Broadwell release was really delayed, and it was extra staggered.
Right, exactly.
So it took a long time to roll out, and the last thing they did was high-end chips. But the Broadwell delay never affected Skylake. So it was always going to be on schedule. So it feels soon because it is really soon after Broadwell. But yeah. It's on target from.
Yeah, good point, good point. So it feels a little staggered, even though it really isn't.
So another product that came out of nowhere and is a big improvement over the last generation is the OnePlus 2. You remember the OnePlus 1, Chris? The phone? It's like a hacker-forward value phone.
Yeah, it's getting some attention because it runs a fairly stock version of Android. It's basically, you know, it's the kind of phone where if Apple made an Android phone, what would it look like? And I feel like that's kind of what they're trying to get at.
Yeah, something like that for sure. Although the last version had a lot of hacker cred because it ran Cyanogen.
Yeah, exactly.
But this one is running their own in-house skin of Android. And it's a nice skin. There's nothing wrong with it. But it's not Cyanogen mod and it's not stock. But it is a very nice phone. It's got good hardware. It's enormous, just like the last one. And it's for sale now. And in certain experience centers in the U.S., they're in San Francisco and New York, and that's it.
Yeah, and they've had some delays. So I think in theory, it's available when they become available any minute now.
But it is only going to cost $329 for the 16 gig.
That's a pretty big deal.
Okay, so in other phone announcements, we've got a new Motorola phone. It's the third generation Moto G. This one is still $180. It's got specs that are way better than last time, and this one is even semi-waterproof.
Yeah, so that's a pretty neat little update to the Moto G. I always thought that was this phone is for a budget phone, absolutely incredible, has absolutely incredible specs for what it's worth, and I feel like it's a nice little phone for people. It's not something to sleep on.
Frankly, I'm surprised I don't see more of these around because, you know, if you're on a a two-year contract, which a lot of people still are, even though they're dying. If you're on a contract and you break your phone, you say, ah, oh, what am I going to do? They told me I need to spend like $700. Yeah, the answer is get a Moto G. Like, it's $180 and it's a good phone.
All right. So speaking of Android, we've also got some news coming out of the Moto X. So we've got some insight into the Moto X. It's going to be $399. And that's a Snapdragon 808. It's got a 1440 pixel screen. And what's kind of interesting about this one is that they appear to be going with a mostly stock Android operating system. So that's kind of interesting in that we've seen a lot of manufacturers really skin Android in the past because Android hadn't been the most capable back then. And we've seen some backlash, particularly from the tech press at Android phones having the skin on it, particularly like Samsung's phones. And so it's very neat to see this Moto X come out and be more or less a stock Android device. And hopefully that means that some of the updates are going to happen more quickly. So this is going to be a Lollipop device, and that's extremely encouraging. It's going to be called the 2015 Moto X, sticking with the Moto X moniker.
Well, so the stock Android version is called the Pure Edition. And they did one of those last year. It eventually showed up on the Google online store. But now Motorola has decided to put this model first. The Pure Edition with stock Android is now front and center of the lineup. It's saying, yeah, go ahead and buy it. They're also announcing Moto X Style and the Moto X Play.
Yeah, so the Moto X Pure seemed to be the most interesting from our perspective here in the peanut gallery, I guess.
Oh yeah, for sure. And it's only $400. Like, if you're ready to drop that much for a good phone, you've got a lot of options, especially with something like this. The first generation of the Moto X was an excellent, and it's only gotten better.
Yeah, it continues to be seemingly an excellent choice. And the screen's not so big at 5.7 inches, Taylor.
Yeah, that's practically tiny. I'm not sure why you need fin on a screen.
Yeah.
It's really just not necessary.
Okay, so in other Android news, I wanted to mention one last thing here. Google released a blog post saying that they're going to start doing some security updates to Android on a monthly basis. So perhaps taking a little lesson from the way Microsoft does monthly patch Tuesday. It's the first Tuesday of the month for Microsoft. And realizing that the security of those devices is extremely important, and updates don't get rolled out often enough. So they're at least saying that with the Nexus devices, you will get a monthly security update. So if something has happened that affects the security of those devices, then it will, they're starting to go on this kind of cadence similar to how Microsoft does. So I think that's an extremely mature thing to do, and I think that's a kind of dully exciting thing to happen to Android.
Highly necessary and too little too late,
yeah,
in my opinion.
Totally, that makes sense.
Okay, so a little bit of Apple news from several weeks ago, but you may not have heard about it, so I wanted to draw your attention to a new iPod Touch. So they updated it for the first time in 3 years and added the latest chips. In fact, 3 years ago, the chip they put in the iPod Touch was already a year old, so they're jumping four processors and chipsets in the new iPod Touch. It's still got the same screen, the same storage capacities, better networking, but basically with a small screen and a current generation process, this
nice.
This is one of the fastest devices in Apple's lineup, and like a really great bet for gaming if you're looking for a dedicated iOS gaming device. And it still starts at $100. Nice enough. Probably most people are just going to buy iPhones. If you're not going to buy that, or if you already have an iPhone, you might be iPod Nano or iPod Touch, which are just new colors, the same as the last 2 years. And they got rid of the little wrist strap. You can't get that for the iPod Touch. And that is all the iPod news for this week and maybe ever.
Yeah, I feel like if you want a device that is a smartphone that is effectively a smartphone but without the data plan, then this is a pretty good option, I suppose. I used to do that. I had a Windows mobile phone that I didn't have a data plan for, and I would just use Wi-Fi when I needed it. Of course, that was a very different time than it is today, but I don't know, maybe for kids or something, it's definitely a good option, because I know there's a huge amount of people that want that class of device. So
yeah,
good option for that.
I mean, unless it has to be POC, an iPod Mini is a way better bet. But this is a perfectly cheap and capable device that is a phone without a con.
Yeah. All right. So I just wanted to mention that it's too late to talk about it. In fact, we talked about the Amazon Echo some time when they announced it. I remember saying that it was like the computer on Star Trek, that you could just ask questions in the room, and I totally get the vision. But since we last podcasted, this thing has actually been released, so people have actually ordered it and gotten it. So it's gotten some, it seems to have captured the imagination of a lot of the tech press out there, so I'm kind of encouraged to see that people are liking it, and I definitely can see the vision of it, so that's very cool to see. So that is on Amazon now. If you're interested, you probably already have one, but I figured I'd mention it.
No, I doubt it. I don't think a lot of people are buying these, and I was surprised to find out many reviewers said it's disappointing as a speaker. I think that is something they should improve on. Like version 2, which couldn't come soon enough. But in other news, Amazon can now sell you those buttons, the wireless buttons that will automatically order you something, a little Tide button they stick on your washing. The Dash buttons are now available to anyone.
Neat. So I should order some.
You
see how
should
that goes.
Not. You definitely.
So LastPass has released a bit of an update to their platform. They're tweaking the way their pricing works. You can now use the desktop LastPass for free or the mobile LastPass. It used to be that you would be able to use the desktop version for free and the mobile one to pay for. But now you can use either one for free. And if you go to use both and sync across platforms, then you're going to have to incur the small yearly cost. So it's a little bit of a change, and I feel like that kind of makes sense. And it's good to see them just keeping up to date. Because there are some people that might not necessarily have a non-mobile. And with that, I think we will turn off the afterburners, Taylor, and we can get into a bit of the end-user stories. What do we got going on here?
Okay, so at the end of July, we got a joint announcement from Intel and Micron saying they invented a new memory technology that is 1,000 times faster than solid-state drives and has a higher memory density than DRAM. So this replaces all memory in your computer. It replaces the RAM. It replaces the flash. It replaces the solid-state drive. You know, if it was cheap enough, it would replace everything. I mean, it's not even on the market, and it probably won't be for a very long time, but
yeah.
It now exists.
Lots of work.
And it's ridiculously fast and fancy. So they call it 3DX Point. And they're also saying that they are not that far off from putting it in consumer devices. So the reason it's so fast, very complicated, new technology, and I don't want to get into all that.
Yeah,
but
transistorless cross-point architecture, Taylor. What's so complicated about that?
Not that much, if you understand all of those words.
Well, so anyway, yeah, this looks interesting. So I've always thought of the components of a computer in general. You have a little bit of memory inside the processor, which is extremely fast, and you back out a little ways, and you've got RAM, which is a little less fast but a little bigger, and then you back out, you get into non-volatile storage, and they're the SSDs, and they're a whole lot bigger and a lot slower than that memory, and you back off again and you get a whole lot bigger magnetic hard drives, and they're a whole lot slower than SSDs. So you kind of have this ring of depending on what your need is, you have this ring of thing of speed versus capacity inside of any given computer. So
and then you back up your hard drives to tape storage, and then
right
you
to
back
tape
up you back up your tape storage to punch cards, right?
Actually, tape is in use by a lot of like video editors and that kind of thing. Where
you don't have a closet full of punch cards that you throw out and update every month?
If you need a whole bunch of cheap, slow storage, tape is actually not a bad for archival storage. Punch cards, I don't think that would work so well. Not sure.
You mean I can get rid of my punch card closet?
Yeah, I don't think you need that.
That's good, because it's been a pain in the butt.
Yeah, and you know, those punch cards, I think, will rot away eventually, too.
Well, that's why I replace them.
Oh, okay, you make a copy.
Well, yeah, I'm not going to...
At Kinko's, right? Like, oh, here comes that weirdo with the punch cards again, and they make a copy for you.
Yeah, that's what.
Well, but anyway, so
the future, Chris.
This technology is very encouraging in that it's taking that class of memory that is the next step out of the cache and making it a whole ton faster. So, you know, I'm not sure of its applicability to the non-volatile space, but the worst thing this technology could possibly do is make the RAM in your computer a whole ton faster. So that's very encouraging.
Yeah. So yeah, it's not a product at this point. It probably won't be for a couple of years unless you have a lot of money, but it's very exciting stuff, and it's almost certainly going to be real.
And I
wanted to talk about it.
I wonder what its power efficiency is, and maybe we can get into some green tech after we're done hearing the end user stories.
Oh, man. I have a green tech story this week, which is so crazy. Maybe you won't find it that crazy. I found it pretty crazy. All right. So this one comes from the personal blog of Rob Reinhart, who you probably don't know who that is, but he is the CEO of the Soylent company that is trying to provide nutrition in the form of nearly flavorless milkshakes, protein shakes, at reasonable costs, at shelf-stable condition to anyone who wants it. I've tried Soylent. It did not taste good, but it did not
That's
kill
not the
me.
Point.
And Rob Reinhart, the CEO of Soylent, has always touted its ecological benefit. You know, a lot of the ingredients are made from low carbon emission or carbon neutral sources. There are no animals that are used, you know, no crazy chemicals like you would think of in this shelf stable nutrition shake. It's all fairly natural to begin with, and they carefully monitor the amount of energy and resources that are going into these shakes, so it's a little counterintuitive. But I didn't realize how serious he was as an environmentalist, but he wrote this blog post called How I Gave Up Alternating Current. Alternating current is what comes through the walls, is what's generated out of power plants. It's any form of turbine energy creates alternating current. If you have solar panels on your house, you have to have an inverter to switch the direct current that the solar panels produce into alternating current, just so that it goes along with all of your stuff. Alternating current is way better for long distance transmission, which is why power plants create it that way. And so if he's saying he gave up alternating current, it means that he not only cut himself off of the grid, but he rid himself of any device that uses a large amount of electricity, and figured out how to, you know, transport himself, feed himself, clothe himself, shelter himself with only a very bare minimum of electrical power required. And he goes through every single bit of it. He starts with the power plants that generate this alternating current. And he's saying this is crazy. And he lives in Los Angeles, by the way, in a house. And he got rid of his car. So he uses Uber or the bus. And both of those use either gas or direct current. Uber happens to be a hybrid or an electric car. And then he got rid of his kitchen. He still has a kitchen, but he doesn't really use it because he drinks Soylent. Or he goes out to eat, and that's sort of just his plan. And then he powers his fan, his computer, his phone, and a Pico projector using a single solar panel and a car battery.
So that is some extreme green living, isn't it?
It is seriously extreme. And he's got a little camping. But that's it. That's everything. That's all his energy. Oh, he doesn't wash his clothes, donates them when he's done with that one. That one's really extreme. I think that's not sustainable in the sense that everyone can.
All right. Yeah, that doesn't sound quite right.
But his monthly power bill is nothing. He calculates everything and he figures out his carbon footprint and he says, you know, anyone in Southern California, what I do, most people in the world need to think about giving up a lot of the creature comforts that we are used to that use so much electricity. So I'm not necessarily advocating adopting his lifestyle, but it's a good read and it's something to.
Yeah, and I think there's some interesting conversation happening now that light bulbs operate on direct current, although they have a little inverter in them to convert from AC to DC. Now that light bulbs are out of, possibly at least, out of the equation, perhaps it's time to convert AC to DC, you know, for the whole home except for the kitchen and wherever your washer is. And maybe that's starting to make a little bit more sense. So, you know, I don't know about this extreme, but maybe it's starting to make a little bit more sense to actually just not bother with the AC distribution in the home.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we can all think about where we could cut back. And it's a lot of people have to think about it for those to change. And, if you have your own home and have already been thinking about something like this, like switching your main lines to 5-volt DC, which would be perfectly acceptable for all your lighting and most of your charging needs for the house, then, you know, by all means, go ahead and do it. But for that to become the standard, for it to make a significant difference, the amount of energy that
huge amount of effort,
which it could, though, and we need to think, we all need to think about it for it to start to become the standard. And that's, in the long run, hopefully going to reduce energy usage by so much. Because if you take out that AC-DC conversion from LED light bulbs, they get about twice as efficient.
Yeah, yeah, that's not surprising. You know, you look around your typical house or apartment now, you see, well, okay, that light is LED, so it has a converter in it, and your TV has a converter in it, and your the charger for your computer and your cell phone, they all have converters in them. And, you know, maybe we're getting to a point where that just doesn't make sense anymore. And I don't think that change, I feel like, is really hard-pressed to ever happen at all now that we've kind of established the standard. But we would save a lot of energy if we did make that. But it's...
Yeah.
A very large and expensive change to make.
My favorite example of this is the car inverter. So in your car, you've got an engine, an AC current generator,
right,
which feeds a battery. So you have to charge it in direct current. You've got AC to DC. And then if you want to run a TV or something on your computer, a lot of people will buy an inverter, which takes DC current and turns it back into AC. So you're going AC to DC to AC. And then if you want to plug in a TV or your laptop or anything else, you have got to go back to. So you're going AC to DC to AC to DC just to charge your phone in an inverter in your car. Now, you could also, if you're going to charge a phone, you could just, you know, get a little USB plug. But if you're going to charge your computer, you probably don't have a plug that can handle 12 volt to 19 volt or whatever your laptop to charge.
So yeah, that is funny.
Back and forth a couple of times in order to get it to work. But you wouldn't have to if we just had a system of DC appliances and plugs, which is perfectly possible and reasonable.
Yeah, and you know, it's obvious that AC is more efficient going across long distances, but in the house, you know, I'm not so sure. I'm sure there's somebody that is far more expert than us that could maybe bring up some issues around that kind of strategy.
There are absolutely. In fact, DC is very bad and for like distances of 50 to 60 feet. So you really have to, depending on the voltage, you have to limit your wire length to a really extreme
amount.
Yeah,
sure, sure.
But there are solutions for that, and you're right, there are other people.
Yeah, well, I think it needs some thinking at this point in time. I feel like we should start to reconsider that. But the standard's already there, so we'll take, if that happens at all, it will take a very, very long time to wander away from that standard. All right, well, we've got a tip of the week from you, sir. What do you got for us?
Yeah, so this is aimed at people who are using Apple Music and who also happen to have iTunes Match. So it turns out there is a bug that if you already had your music on iTunes Match in Apple's cloud and you sign up for Apple Music and download or move around files, it takes your music and adds Apple Music DRM to it. And it shouldn't do that, and Apple knows that.
Whoops.
But yeah, it's a whoops. Anyway, there is a specific procedure that you can follow to reverse this problem. And that's our tip of the shared by 9to5Mac. So I'm not going to get into it because probably most people don't have a few do. And you're using iTunes Match, especially like I am. This matters to me. But if you are a person who has iTunes Match and the Apple Music free trial, definitely read this article, because otherwise some bad stuff.
Neat. Well, that's good to see that there's something you can do about it. All right. So I wanted to quickly mention, and this is going to be our app pick of the week, is that Plex has completely overhauled their iOS client. So if you're somebody who's using Plex as some kind of home server or home theater solution of some kind, and you're an iOS user, then you've probably got an update waiting for you. And I, from what I can see from the screenshots, you know, I don't have an iOS device to use Plex on. It looks like a pretty nice little update. So that's very cool to see.
Yeah, that's pretty exciting. I have not used Plex in a while. I don't think I've ever used the iOS app, but maybe I'll check it out.
Yeah, see, I use it on Android, and more often I use it in a web browser, Plex.tv. So I'm definitely not going to see this. For anyone who's using that combination of devices, you've got, you know, it's like Christmas morning. Well, maybe I overstated that. All right, Taylor,
All right.
We have our last story of the week, our kicker, and like we often do, we're reaching for a story from space.
Yeah, this one really blew my mind, and it makes perfect sense. So this is a new series of images, not from Mars or Ceres or Pluto or Charon. This one is from near-Earth orbit. Actually, pretty far Earth orbit. It's about 1,000,000 miles directly towards the sun in the first Lagrangian point of the orbit, which means
right.
that it always sits directly between Earth and the sun because gravity and orbits balance out. It's actually kind of an unstable little spot. The Discover satellite, which arrived there a few weeks ago, has to use fuel occasionally just to stay in its spot. But its advantage is that it always has a full sunlit of the Earth. So we talked about this Earth image on a previous show, and this the satellite that Al Gore talked about when he talked about having a full-time live image of Earth on TV. But it finally captured something really interesting, which is the moon coming between it and the Earth. The moon orbits at about 250,000 miles away, so this is four times as far as the moon, and got to see the full sunlit backside of the moon transit directly across the Earth. And so no one's ever had a picture of the whole back of the moon before, because you have to see it from the sun. You have to be on the
right.
sun side of it.
That's cool, too, because you get to see what it looks like for the moon to transit in front of the Earth in the same way that we have seen other celestial bodies transit each other, and we can observe and take data from that or whatever. And it's cool to see that, you know, the same thing happening, but a little closer to home.
Yeah. And the image is so striking. Hard to believe how dark the moon looks, but that is actually the real color of the moon. It almost looks like a fake image, but the moon is actually really dark compared to the Earth. And they made a GIF and they posted it, and GIFs right now. It's pretty awesome.
So why did they turn it into peanut butter?
I don't know what to tell you, Chris. Choosing moms choose GIFs.
Of the moon.
Well, yeah.
Anyway, so we have a link in the show notes. Would like to go see that. It's pretty cool. Highly, highly recommended. And you're totally right. It looks fake. It looks like Unreal. It's very cool that we are in a place where we can capture this kind of image. Very cool. All right. Well, I think that will do it for this week. And not so bad considering how much time we missed in between shows. So, Taylor, if somebody wanted to try to contact you on the internet in some way, how would they go about doing this?
Well, preferably by taking a GIF of the moon. if you have one of those ready to go, it's all queued up, then you can send it to me on Twitter. I'm at TaylorPhone, TaylorPhone.
Okay, that works. And if you'd like to send me some peanut butter, my Twitter handle is at Chris Hale Barnes. So I think that'll do it for this week. So thank you, everyone, for listening to the show. And, of course, you can find more information, including the show notes, over there at thedigitalmediazone.com under the end user. That's THENDUSR. The DMZ has a few other podcasts. You can listen to Entertainment 2.0, which we talked about earlier. You can also listen to the home automation podcast, Home On. You can send us some feedback. We've got an email. It's theenduser@thedigitalmediazone.com, or you can follow us together on Twitter. We are at theenduser. You can join us in the chat room as we record the show live every Wednesday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, although we've been fairly sporadic about that in this summer, as we were discussing. I am your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
I'm Futurist Prime Taylor Muller.
Thanks for listening, folks. We will see you next week. Bye-bye.